People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note, and I'm very excited to introduce you to my guest. His name is Albie Sachs, a South African lawyer, activist, writer, and a former judge appointed to the first Constitutional Court of South Africa by Nelson Mandela, no less. And one of the main reasons, apart from Albie's extraordinary life, that I've invited him here is because he has just turned 90. So a grand age. Albie, welcome, a warm welcome to Fine Music Radio.
It's lovely to be here, Rodney.
How does it feel to be 90? Did you ever think you'd make 90?
Now that I'm 90, it seems very natural and inevitable. And in fact, I've had a glorious 10 years being 80. And I recommend it to everybody.
To get
people
into their
seem
80s.
To dread it. For me, it's been a golden age. Quite a few hardships, disappointments, and so on. Mm-hmm. But in terms of actual expression, articulation of energy, of doing things, accomplishing things, it's been a wonderful decade.
But you look well, Albie. Are you, in fact, in good nick health-wise?
I'm in very good nick. I've got a little problem with my knee.
Okay, that's
unexpected.
And I'm
told that even my knee niggle can be dealt with. So
okay,
I'm in very good nick, yeah.
And, of course, the question to ask somebody like you after the life you've had, which we'll cover, is what does it feel like to be retired? Or are you retired? What are you doing now?
I don't use the R word.
Okay, good.
I don't
okay.
use the R word. If you do it, then it becomes you.
Right.
So I say when my term at the court came to an end, a new phase of my life began.
Okay. Which is a very positive way of looking at things, isn't it? So, in fact, you are still working, let's put it that way, without using the R word.
You know, I had to finish off an interview earlier. And even that interview followed on another interview I'd had this morning, and that followed on some Pilates that I'd been doing.
Oh, so Pilates is keeping you going.
Pilates helps enormously.
Albie, I wanted to ask you, you've chosen some interesting music, which we'll come to in a moment, because I was interested to see your selection. But I wanted to ask you just a little bit about, you were born in Johannesburg, and it was interesting at that early stage of your life, isn't it, because your parents had come here having fled Lithuania to come and settle in South Africa in Johannesburg. Was that an easy childhood you had? Were they were in a sense activists as well, weren't they?
I remember my childhood with pleasure. Fun, interesting, curious. My younger brother had a similar childhood, but he was unhappy. Partly he had health problems. Mm-hmm. And it was growing up, my mom and my dad separated. She came down from Johannesburg, the two little infant children, and we grew up near the beach, which was amazing.
Oh, and so you grew up in Cape Town?
Grew up in Cape Town, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And I tell people, since it's a Cape Town program, I grew up in Cape Town, I went to school in Cape Town, went to high school in Cape Town, I went to university in Cape Town, and I went to jail in Cape Town.
There you go. One shouldn't laugh at that, but the way you said it sounds quite funny. When you came to Cape Town, you had already, although you said you were an infant, you were very small, you were aware of the fact that your parents were activists. You were made aware very early of the role of an activist.
You know, it wasn't even aware that they were activists. That was the world for me. And my mom would say to me and my little brother, tidy up, tidy up, Uncle Moses is coming. And Uncle Moses wasn't Moses Cohen or Moses Cantor, he's Moses Kutani. He was the General Secretary of the Communist Party of South Africa, and my mother was what was called his typist. And she had enormous respect for him. So I grew up in a home where it was natural for a white woman to have great respect and affection for an African man. And for me, that was the world. I had to become aware of another world outside was racist and drove people away and had negative attitudes. So that was the biggest blessing I could have been given by my parents.
Yes, I read somewhere that you realized after having become aware of apartheid and all that how inhuman it was simply because lovely people like your mother's boss existed who were perfectly normal, but we were taught to treat them abnormally.
Yes, so the abnormality wasn't the world I was living in. Yeah. Abnormality was the racist world. It was even before apartheid, the term apartheid was used, that seemed to be completely wrong and irrational and crazy, not just morally wrong in some kind of intellectual abstract way, but just mad, because it was manifestly so.
What I find so interesting now is all of us who grew up white in the apartheid era, we now look back and think how ridiculous it was. At the time, we were brainwashed. You know, that was life, the black maid in the back garden, as a slave almost. And now you look back and you think how ridiculous it was that there were separate benches, that people weren't allowed here into the Artscape building to watch a play. And as you say, the iniquity of it is what, in retrospect, seems so extraordinary.
You know, people boycotted it. It wasn't called the Artscape then.
It was called Nico Milan.
Yes, Nico Milan.
That's right.
And I suggested turning Nico around to Icon and somehow showing the transformation. But many people I knew from Cape Town, I'd been in exile for a long time, refused to go to the Nico and even to Artscape at first, because it was associated with white theater to show to the whites that we are civilized and carrying on and evading the international boycott and so on. Yes. It became a symbol of apartheid.
I remember I worked at the SBC for many years, and a man came in called Govan Reddy, who took over radio. And I was celebrating my 20th year in radio or something. And he said, I can't understand, you've been in this place for 20 years. It's important to change jobs. And he also used to say, white people would listen to classical music while the townships were burning, which is a bit hard truth. And this is what happened, didn't it? We lived in a bubble, an unreal world. But you didn't live in a bubble.
You know, talking about that, when I came back from exile after 20 years, the first day I climbed Table Mountain, that had been my dream for 20 years. The first Thursday I went to the City Hall Symphony Concert. And I remember somebody came up to me at the interval and she said, welcome back, L.B. Sachs. For 20 years, you never missed a concert except when you went to jail.
Right.
And in a sense, the music was a little bit of softness. I could lose myself in Beethoven and Brahms. Sibelius came in for a couple of hours and then go back into the world where am I going to be raided tonight? Am I going to be thrown into prison tomorrow?
Even when you came back from exile, you were still in danger, were you, of being raided?
No. When I came back, I felt they tried to, I'll speak about this later, blow me up and kill me. I'd survived. I'm okay. We're on the move. We're going forward. So I didn't have that fear anymore.
Oh, good.
I'll
be talking about the concerts and all that. Your first piece of music I see is that beautiful slow movement of Dvorak's A New World Symphony, the famous Going Home theme. I'm intrigued to know why you chose that, apart from the fact that it's so beautiful.
I chose it because when I was thrown into prison under what was called the 90-day law, 1st of October 1963, I'm a young advocate, I'm entering my chambers, and there's like five, six burly people who seem to be reading newspapers, tying their shoelaces, suddenly spring to life, placing me under arrest under the 90-day law, and I'm in prison, and I'm locked up, and so this is what it's like, and I go da-da-da-da to make myself feel brave, and the days pass, and it's terrible. Prison just filled with noise, but it's noise sounds of door slamming, of orders, of commands, and of drunk people screaming, 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 and then I hear some whistling, and it's not that ugly music. It's not a drunk person can't bear being locked up in prison. It's not a guard shouting at a prisoner. It's beautiful. And I whistle back. And I whistle ANC songs. No response. I whistle the red flag. No response. Whistle other things. No response. And then I hear, da, 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 da. And I whistle back. There's another human being out there like me.
You whistle the same theme back.
And that's the one piece of music that connected us in this horrible, horrible, horrible prison. And I'd be doing my exercises afterwards, and I'd hear the whistling, and I'd do 50 press-ups, and I'm 43, 44, and I said, please wait, 45, 46, 47, wait for now, and I get up, and I'm tired, and I can hardly whistle. And so that music, in a sense, is the music of humanity. So happened, Dvorak was in the United States, and he picked up the Negro spiritual going home, and in prison you longing to go home. It had extra layers, and it turned out the other person, the whistler, was Dorothy Adams, and she'd been in what was called the Neville Alexander Group in the underground. So we weren't even in the same political groups, but we were united by this beautiful music. Afterwards, I might say, We worked together in London some years later, and when I returned to South Africa, she became my assistant.
Well, that's part of the slow movement, the Largo, of the Symphony No. 9 by Dvorak, known as the New World Symphony, with that theme, that famous theme played on the cor anglais, which acquired the title Going Home. The first choice of my guest this week on People of Note on Fine Music Radio, Albie Sachs, talking about an extraordinary life. And when you spoke about prison and this lady whistled back to you, you said that she worked for you. You're going to tell us more about her.
Yes, she came from Dorothy Adams, as she then was, came from Wellington, and she joined the resistance to apartheid. And then after her imprisonment here, she went to England, and I met her there later. She married a Quaker named Williams. And when I was blown up, which brings me to the second piece of music that I'd like to play, she read about it. She wrote to me, could she help me in any way? And I said, yes, you can help me with writing letters and so on. And she ended up returning to South Africa with her husband and becoming my assistant when I worked at the University of the Western Cape as what was called a professor extraordinary.
Right, okay. But before we get to that story, that traumatic part of your life, you were talking about prison and what it's like in there and hearing the noises and the banging and the horrible orders and things. But you were also in solitary confinement for a while. I can't remember how long.
No, the whole time was in solitary confinement.
Even with this whistling thing?
Yes, yes.
Oh.
Yes, that was the point. No okay. visitors, no appearance in court, no family, no lawyers. It's total isolation, and you just sit there and you stare at your toes, you stare at the wall, you stare at your knees, the wall, your toes. And I developed all sorts of devices to try and keep sane. And one of them was to try and remember all the states in the United States of America. And I couldn't remember, was it 48 or 50 or 52? And I didn't have pencil and paper then. I couldn't write it down. I think I once got up to 47. And then I would go through the alphabet singing songs. Always, Because, Charmaine. Anybody wants to know the hit songs of 1963?
Yeah.
Just has to look at my jail diary to see. I think.
Did you sing out loud?
I listed them there. And I'll be singing loud to hear my voice, to feel mm-hmm. active, mm-hmm. and to feel a little bit cheeky because you feel so diminished.
Yes.
You feel like a worm. You're just nothing. You're useless. You mean nothing in the world because you're not in contact, you're not speaking to people. And I kept telling myself, Albie, you're in jail not for being bad but for being good. I had to tell myself that. Mm-hmm. And a good day I'd just be depressed. I felt like suicidal most of the time. And that's what solitary confinement does to you. The singing helped enormously, and my favorite song was always, when I sing it today, young people don't even know the song, but you're old enough to remember Irving Berlin's
he said, pointing at me.
Love song.
Yeah,
and
it
instead of saying, I'll be loving you always, with a love that's true always, I would say, I'll be living here always, year after year, always, in this little cell that I know so well, I'll be living swell, always, always. And I'd
go into the
circle court. Around, and then I'd carry on, be staying in, always, keeping up my chin, always, not for but an hour, not for but a week, not for 90 days, but always.
Oh, my goodness.
It was called the, and now if I get a chance, and I'm speaking to a very posh audience, elite audience in Ottawa or in Nairobi or wherever it might be, and there are judges in the audience, I sing that song. I sing that song because it's a reminder of my past, but a reminder that judges are human beings and that we have lives outside of law, and that theme comes through always.
Yeah. Very powerful, those words you put there. How big was was it very small, your cell?
I was in three different cells. The first was at Maitland Police Station, and that would have been about three paces across and two paces wide with one high window,
mm-hmm.
and it had a toilet in the corner with you could pull a little metal thing and get the gurgling. And that was my only activity, was flushing the toilet, and a mat on the floor.
So
and
not
it's
even
very
a bed.
Weird, sitting no bed, very weird lying on the floor, and the guards are coming. They mustn't see me on the floor. They mustn't see me on the floor, you know, and I'd get up.
Did they leave the light on all the time?
No.
So at least you knew when it was day and night.
I knew, and I would listen for the sound of chimes mm-hmm. from, I think it was Maitland Town Hall, to get the hour.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
Then I was moved to Weinberg. It was a cell that was actually smaller with a toilet in, but it had a bed and it had a little exercise space outside. Mm-hmm. And then the third cell I went to was at the Caledon Square police station. It was just a tiny cell off the staircase. That was the smallest of all. Mm-hmm. A bed would take up the whole side, a little space in front, and that was the smallest, yeah.
Were you allowed any books to read?
So at first, nothing, just the Bible. I would read 2.5 pages a day and save up because I didn't know if I was going to be years there. And suddenly on what was the 27th day, the station commander comes in waving a piece of paper. If they'd listened to me, this would never have happened. And he hands me a piece of paper and my eyes used to running down the page.
Yes, because of the Bible, yes.
And it doesn't go across. And it says in the Supreme Court of South Africa, Cape of Good Hope Provincial Division, in front of Banks J and Fun, the name will come back to me in a minute. It's hereby ordered that the applicant Albert Louis Sachs be allowed reading matter and writing material. Now, until then, I'd been raging against the legal profession and the laws, all a whole lot of rubbish, and I'm picked up right in front of the High Court in Cape Town. No charge, no trial, nothing. I hate the legal profession. Now suddenly the law is the most magnificent thing that's ever been invented, and I get my first books. And the first book they give me is the Police Gazette. The second book they give me is Die Huisgenoot.
Oh, the magazine.
I actually love Die Huisgenoot because it was calm and it was nice stories to read,
to earth,
and
yes.
I would look forward to the next sequence of the story of the librarian, and this clever man comes from Johannesburg and walks by and doesn't even look at her, and you know how the story's going to end. And then finally I got books and did some of my most important reading of my life. The two great books were Moby Dick by Herman Melville and Don Quixote's by Cervantes. Magnificent books read in that kind of a setting. It was grand.
How long were you there? How long were you in prison?
So 168 days 168. Altogether. Yeah.
Okay. Albie, let's have the next piece of music, which is the slow movement of that magnificent Beethoven piano sonata called the Hammerklavier Sonata. And this has an important story attached, doesn't it? A very important story.
Very, very, yes. Very important story. I'd been blown up by a car bomb in Mozambique, lost my right arm, sight in one eye. The doctors were fantastic. They saved my life there, and they even knew about HIV then, so I had 7 liters of blood that was free of the virus. And I slowly recovered there. I'm flown to London. My recuperation proceeds there. I learned to sit up. I learned to use a commode. I remember saying to myself, I shit, therefore I am. I told myself a joke. I laugh, therefore I am. I stand, therefore I am. And my first holiday is in Portugal. And a friend of mine, Professor Teresa Beleza, whom I'd met in Portugal and seen in when I was working in Mozambique, said I must come for a holiday. She said when she saw me, she was shocked. I'm wheeled in a wheelchair and for as long as I like. But my spirit was quite strong. And my spirit got stronger when we would climb into a bath together, hot water, and she would put on music. She said, Albie, you've just got to listen to the slow movement of the Hammerklavier. And lovely, warm, hot water. I'm wondering, can I make love? Will my body be okay? Am I normal? Am I a human being? And Beethoven is playing my marvelous, marvelous, wonderful Beethoven. And then she
story.
Would cheat, because if I wanted to listen to the slow movement, you have to begin at the beginning with the opening movement. Mm-hmm. And then, I'm not sure, I think it comes third in the second movement, the third movement. And then you hear the fourth movement, then you've got to go back to the beginning. She just got out, played the slow movement over and over and over again, the water splashed. It's warm, it's wonderful, it's mad, and I'm recovering. So that music is like deep in my heart.
it's sad to fade these great pieces, but they were. We played the part of the slow movement of Beethoven's Hammerklavier Sonata. And it was the second choice of my guest this week on People of Note. Fine Music Radio, People of Note, brought to you by Peter Doreen Productions. And Albie Sachs is my guest, telling us amazing stories. Do you know, I hope I'm not being too intrusive here, but do you remember the actual incident of the bomb and blowing your arm off, or is it gone blank in your mind?
It's so strong in my mind because I speak about it all the time.
Yes, I'm sure you are. Sorry,
it's in different ways.
Right, right.
So, and of course, it's something you don't forget, you know, very easily. Mm-hmm. And I was in Mozambique. I'd been lecturing at the Faculty of Law at the new university there, at Wat Madlayini University. It was closed down. I was now working in the Ministry of Justice as director of research, doing fascinating, interesting, really interesting work. And then off to the beach one day. It's a public holiday. Something terrible's happening to me. I don't know what it is. I used to climb Table Mountain and bang my head on an overhang.
Yes.
But then it would clear, and it's not clearing.
Yeah.
And then I'm total darkness, and I hear a voice saying, Albie, this is Eva Garrido. You're in Maputo Central Hospital. Your arm is in lamentable condition. You must face the future with courage. And I said, what happened? And a woman's voice said, it was a car bomb. And I felt joyous. I knew I was safe.
Oh,
that the Mozambican authorities were on our side supporting our struggle.
Yes.
And I was not being kidnapped to be thrown into jail in South Africa. Mm. And I had a total conviction as I got better, my country would get better.
And look what's happened, yeah. And your eye, that was also, you were blinded in your left eye, weren't you?
Yes, I have to feel, yes, it's my left eye. was blinded.
And there was a pedestrian killed, wasn't there? A pedestrian was killed in that.
I discovered afterwards that a pedestrian walking by mm-hmm. some months later died from his wounds. And you know, Rodney, I feel so distressed when people attack migrants coming in from Mozambique and elsewhere. You know, we were like the migrants fleeing from South Africa to come back and fight for freedom in our thousands. And the countries received us, and they were bombed, and there was civil war, and they paid such a heavy price. And this man died for the bomb meant for me. Mm. It's that rejection, you know, of our African connections that I find extremely, extremely distressing.
Albie, I wanted to ask you, you went into law quite – I mean, that was your profession initially, wasn't it? You became a lawyer,
yes.
Ultimately a judge, and then a judge appointed to the Constitutional Court. Was it always going to be law that you were going to follow? I mean, initially, before you became more active as an activist.
You know, people used to say when you matric, Albie, what are you going to do?
Yes.
And I say, I'm going to be a doctor. Oh, that's nice. What are you going to do? I'm going to be a doctor. Oh, that's nice. And I'd say, I'm going to be a lawyer. I don't know why I changed. I had a vague feeling that I could do something good in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became a lawyer, and I enjoyed the classes and the studying and law. And I had this terrible tension between beautiful lectures about law and freedom and justice and doing the right thing, up on the hills at UCT, and the professors believed in that. And at night I would go down to the townships or to Elsie's Rivier or wherever it was, the shanties, just people with candlelight, you'd see the eyes, the mouth. And they hated the law. The law traced them, demanded their passes, sent them into prison for debt, was on their tail. They hated the law, but they'd give their lives for justice. Mm. The professors loved the law, but they wouldn't give their lives for justice.
That's very interesting.
And only when years later we came to write the Constitution, I realized that the great ideas of the ages, which had been fought for by people all over the world for justice, those great ideas were very meaningful if combined with the passion of the people who needed the rights. And so writing the Constitution helped heal South Africa. It helped heal Albie as well.
Well, you're very often credited with playing a major part in writing the Constitution, but then I read somewhere you said, no, it's not just me, and you mentioned Oliver Tambo, and because you'd had meetings with Oliver Tambo, and he had made suggestions, hadn't he, for the Constitution?
More than that, he set up a Constitution Committee He located the idea of a constitution deep in the heart of the African National Congress, the liberation movement, and he was terrified when the day came to negotiate, when we pushed them into negotiations, we wouldn't be ready. And so he set up this team in 1985, long before the Berlin Wall fell, long before Gorbachev and the Soviet Union changing, because there was a long tradition in the ANC, a Bill of Rights in 1923, African claims during World War II with the Bill of Rights, the Freedom Charter, and I attended the Congress of the People as a kind of Bill of Rights. And he said, build on that tradition. And democracy will be the mechanism for achieving self-determination for the African people, together with all the people of South Africa. So it was very profound, very meaningful, and we were quite a big team in exile, and we come back to South Africa. There are people dreaming about this on Robben Island, in the underground, people in the courts, marvelous lawyers like Ishmael Mohammed, George Bezos and others, fighting for fundamental rights. And 3 or 4 or 5 years of hard debates and hard struggles, and finally getting a constitution that's held up throughout the world as one of the most progressive
in the whole world. Yeah,
it doesn't. It's not self-fulfilling. You don't automatically get to enjoy the rights that are there, but it establishes. It establishes the values, the goals, and the instruments that people can use to enjoy those rights. So that's been hugely fulfilling for me to be part of the team that produced that.
I'm sure, my goodness. And as you say, respected all over the world, this constitution of ours. And yet, there are some people who try and change it now and again. But we won't mention any names like that. We'll rather go to your next piece of music. Abdullah Ibrahim, Mannenberg. Why have you included that in your list?
Gosh, you know, Abdullah, I knew him when he was Dollar Brand.
Yes.
And somebody introduced me to hard jazz. And it came from America. And it was had a very strong implantation in Cape Town. And I'd go to the concerts and hear Abdullah and Kippie Moeketsi and local people and so on playing. And I've often said our jazz musicians wrote our constitution in music before we lawyers wrote it in words. They were ahead of us. They were finding a fusion of sounds that brought everybody in, deeply drawing on our own culture, but part of international music making. And then Mannenberg, I returned from exile, and people love it, almost loving it to death, because it was becoming almost trite. And it was so Cape Town for me. It had a Cape Town bounce and a feeling and a quality. And I just loved it. So when in March 1994, we were about to have elections.
Yes.
I'm not enjoying electioneering. I hate saying we're the best, vote for us, and so on. I want to do something. So I repeated the run I did when I was released in 1964 in March from Caledon Square. I ran all the way through Cape Town to the sea. Now I'm going to run with my shortened right arm. Can I do it all the way to the sea? And this time the mayor gives me a big kiss. It was Patricia Salkus. The TV people running backwards following me. I had an espresso at Giovanni's. It's not a banned substance. And I could make it. I was strong enough to make it. And down on the beach is Basil Mannenberg could see with a saxophone to play me diving into the water. It was such a joyous moment for me, my personal celebration of the momentous occasion that we all going to vote as equals for the first time. And so that music then became, it was called the anthem of the people, the music of struggle. And I was really close to Abdullah many times of his life. I attended the conferences. I was actually the lawyer, the advocate who asked for his divorce and got a big laugh in court when Judge President Bayer says, "Oh, the jazz musician," and us creeping lawyers all laugh, ha 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 ha, as they said the most amusing thing in the whole world. And then I met him in exile and with Satima, and then he came to Maputo to play a series of concerts, and it was on the day that Ruth First was assassinated. And he played that night the most exquisite music, and South African security hit the electricity. It was dark. Somebody found a candle, put the candle next to the grand piano, and he played this most exquisite music for our sister Ruth, who died. So Abdullah, in that sense, is my friend, the messenger of wonderful music. I heard him play in New York. I've heard him play back in South Africa. And that's possibly his best known. He doesn't like being known simply for Mannenberg.
I know.
But,
but he can't help
on this occasion, let's hear it, yeah.
Famous piece by Abdullah Ibrahim, that Mannenberg, and it was another choice of my guest, my very interesting guest, Albie Sachs. We're talking about his life. We were talking about you getting involved in law. You became a judge, and your involvement in writing the Constitution, let alone the Bill of Rights before that. But apparently you always wanted to be a judge, and then you made it to the Constitutional Court. And that must have been a great moment for you to be appointed a judge of our Constitutional Court.
Wrong and right. I never wanted to be a judge. I never imagined being a judge.
Oh, okay.
And you know, I tell people, people say, follow your dreams.
Mm.
And I say, don't follow your dreams. Follow your life and your dreams will follow you. That's been my experience. I never dreamt of being a judge. I loved it, getting onto that court, because I wasn't a judge at the citadel of oppression, elitism, domination. I was a judge with a wonderful constitution that had been written by people who'd suffered so much, been in prison, underground, resistance, support from all over the world, and now upholding the values we'd fought for. And in that sense, I was in a bubble created by the Constitution of the values we believed in. It was a continuation of my life. One of the best decisions I made in my life was to step out of the political domain, make myself available to be a judge, getting on to the Constitutional Court.
Interesting you say that was the best decision, because you were never an MP, were you? Not in hard politics.
No. And I'm not against MPs. It's very easy to belittle members of parliament and so on. They're important. Many of them do wonderful work. And they're part of the democratic process. We need them. We need more MPs who are good and honest and hardworking and who listen with diverse points of view. But not for me. It wasn't the life for me. I much preferred, as it turned out, being on the court, upholding the values for which we'd fought so hard.
And Albie, do you still do talks? Are you still invited to address people locally and internationally? Are you still traveling internationally?
You know, I do talks. I take a few intervals in between the talks.
Well, why not? You have a lot to say. But are you still invited to address
invited
people?
Invited nonstop. You know, now we're planning for the Canadian Supreme Court is 150 years old. And will I come there and speak on the opening day about apex top courts? I get an invitation from Berkeley University Law School, quite a famous one. They're celebrating 30 years of the Human Rights Center. Can I go there? Invitation to go to Lake Bled, Slovenia. They have an annual conference. Legal things come up. The invitations pouring in all the time.
Do you accept them all?
I accept the ones that I really want to go to, that I like.
Mm-hmm.
Local ones, I can accept most of them. Some I'll do online if traveling becomes difficult. And international ones, I accept them if I can have a bed to sleep on traveling. That's vital. And then secondly, if my wife, Vanessa, who's here with me in the studio, can travel with me. It's fun. She's a great support in all sorts of ways, and we do these journeys together.
Vanessa's been a great support. You've been very quiet sitting there, Vanessa, just because she's our support system in the studio here. Vanessa is Albie's wife of some years now, isn't it? You've been married for a while. How long, Albie?
We got married in 2006, and Oliver was pushing our son, who's now a giant, a hunk, pushing to get out.
Yes.
And my colleague Kate O'Regan said, Albie, there's something I've got to speak to you about. I said, it's okay, Kate, we're getting married. Don't worry. And we did it at the court with the choir singing. It was jubilant. It was joyous. And we've been living together for about 30 years now.
You know, the thing that has struck me most about the two of you being here, and Albie, because I'm talking to you, is a sense of peace, of happiness, contentment. As you said earlier, you're well, you've got your health on your side besides your awful assassination attempt, but you've come back and you've witnessed, thank goodness, what's happened in this country, which must mean a lot to you from those early days.
It's a great healer. And even, you know, surviving the bomb was so important for me. Somehow if I could get through that, other things became so much less significant. You don't allow relatively small things to upset you. Mm-hmm. And I managed that. Okay, I don't say a Superman, but it gave a perspective. And whereas for the years I was in England, I used to say, even when I'm happy, I'm unhappy. Mozambique, I would say I'm happy even when I'm unhappy, because I was so close to the issues. I carried with me the burden of the solitary confinement, sleep deprivation afterwards, all the time, and the bomb, it blew away. those concerns, and it was there almost the bomb liberated me, and that was 1988.
Isn't that interesting?
I don't recommend bomb treatment for liberation of the human soul.
Don't try it at home.
But it worked in that way in my case,
And were you right-handed initially?
I tell people I was ambidextrous, equally useless with both hands.
Okay.
But in fact, I was right-handed. And then one day I'm in Vienna getting my first massage. A woman who'd been to Mozambique met me there. English wasn't very good. Massage for freedom fighter? Come on. Once she started, wow, this is the life. Struggle, forget about it. And then she said, were you right-handed? I made the joke about ambidextrous. She said, serious? I said, I was. She said, you're lucky you lost your right arm. And I'm thinking, what? And she says, normally people use their right arm to keep the world away. Now you will have a much more gracious connection with the world.
Wow, what a thing to say.
It's a lovely thing to say. It's very consoling. And I actually feel that. Mm-hmm. I feel that. So I had to learn to write with my left. I'm sitting up in bed and you can fly, 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 fly. Dog, 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 dog. And it took me a day or 2 days. And I had a horrible handwriting, like a standard 2 schoolboy, not corrected. And I thought, now at least I can get a Mont Blanc, ping, macho handwriting, and it came out like a standard 2 schoolboy. But my words are actually written in concrete on the Constitutional Court, a big plinth, where all the judges wrote the words human dignity, equality, freedom in one of the 11 official languages. I can say my words are written in concrete.
It's an interesting view, actually. Albie, because we're running out of time, it always happens in radio, the one thing I wanted to ask you about was about the Albie Sachs collection. Just tell me briefly what that is.
The idea came when Amal and George Clooney decided to establish what they call the Albies, an award given to people who fought for justice in different parts of the world, and I was one of the first recipients, and George did a beautiful drawing of a figure with one long arm, one short arm, and that's become the basis of the statuette that's given to people. So I thought, maybe then if the Albies are being awarded, people want to know, who is this guy? And we approached the Ford Foundation, who were supporting the awards, and they agreed to give quite a substantial grant to create the Albie collection. And that's why my 90s are proving to be such a golden period, because we have great creatives and we're filming discussions with Tandy Matthews about all the cases that I wrote judgments for in the court and what was my thinking as judges. Then also an audio book on my life and other themes from my life and films. And I'm just living in a very, very beautiful dream that's real, and it's real being in a dream.
Albie, it's been inspirational talking to you, to listen to what you're saying. So come back when you're 100, will you? And we'll catch up on your 90s. But now you've chosen, as to say goodbye, Song for Africa, that lovely piece with Sibongile Kamalo.
Yes, that connects my period in exile with my return to South Africa. And Sibongile, more than anybody, managed to fuse in a most seamless way traditional African music and sounds with very refined classical music, with jazz, with everything. And this is a song that I first heard in exile, the Song for Africa, sung by a group of young students at the Eduardo Mondlane University from South Africa. Very, very beautiful. I've never heard it in South Africa. And now I'm hearing Sibongile singing it with the whole orchestra, with her magnificent voice. And I can't think of a better way of ending this particular interview.
Albie Sachs, thank you very, very much. Thank you very much indeed. And happy birthday. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.